Good morning. At 9:05, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness to order. Good morning, everyone. And if you could remember to turn your cell phones to vibrate or off, that would be ideal. Thank you. And since we're I'm going to gavel in an informational hearing on the Oregon Military Families Task Force House Bill 3391 from 2011, and go ahead and call up ODVA Director Cameron Smith and State Family Program Director for the National Guard, Michelle
Kachowski.
Thank
Michelle
you.
Do you mean a quick camera?
Please identify yourself for the record and
good morning, Vice Chair Spagan and Vice Chair Parrish and members of the committee. For the record, I am Cameron Smith, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Good morning, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish. My name is Michelle Kachowski, and I'm the Oregon National Guard State Family Program Director.
So it is great to have you all back in the building and great to be before you today to give you an update on the Oregon Military Task Force. And driving down today, I was thinking yesterday we had so many military uniforms in the Senate veterans on some great briefs from the Oregon National Guard, and it was led by General Hokanson. And driving down today, I was thinking of who we celebrate as our heroes and who we recognize and who we celebrate. And our new Adjutant General, General Hokanson, has an amazing story. Grew up in Happy Camp, went to West Point, Air Cav, before joining the Oregon National Guard, over 100 air rescue firefighting missions. He's commanded at every level, from company battalion to brigade, led the largest deployment of the Oregon National Guard since World War II in 2009-2010 to Iraq with the 41st Infantry Brigade, has been a Chief of Staff of Task Force Phoenix in Afghanistan, led back in the Guard Bureau, a two-star general, and now our Adjutant General. And it is a resume that can make you feel bad about yourself. But I think the saving grace is that he did not do it alone. And when the governor selected the General Hokanson as the Adjutant General, I think both Michelle and I agree that his better half, Miss Kelly Hokanson, an amazing woman who has held down the home front and been that rock for him throughout all of his career, raised three amazing children, two of whom are back at West Point now, following in their father's footsteps. Just an amazing family, and I think epitomizes what our military families are, from the top at the Oregon National Guard, but all the way down through across the active duty, the Guard, the Reserves. Just amazing stories of our military families, but they are the unsung heroes. They don't wear the uniform, they don't get the awards, they don't get the medals. So this task force was really, how do we make sure we're just not honoring our military families at the end of a career, forgetting them, but really looking hard at what we can do to support them throughout their efforts. So the task force was established in 2011 out of the legislative session in 2011, House Bill 3391. Its main purpose was to identify ways to improve and expand services between military and civilian communities. And I think great insight from the legislature and the governor and folks teeing up this legislation in terms of really identifying who should be on it. And I would say this was not the professional public sector lobbying crew on this task force, but truly military families from across the state. So we had parents, we had Gold Star families, family of a Purple Heart awardee, adolescents, teenagers of military families, spouses, both support from ODVA and the Oregon National Guard with Michelle, and really all branches across the active duty, the Guard, the Reserves, and then as much as possible trying to get geographic representation from across the state. Zach Gallagher-Long, who was the chair of the task force, his brother was killed in Afghanistan by sniper fire when he was supporting the Marines as a corpsman. An inspiring group of people, and just an honor, I think, for both Michelle and myself to work with. At the same time, as inspiring as this group has been, also just an incredible challenge and some frustration. Because they are real people with real lives, it has been hard to convene them as regularly as we'd want. When you've got kids, you know, the adolescents, the teenagers are in school, you know, reaching out to our Eastern Oregon, when we didn't have a budget to necessarily haul them in, give them mileage, give them reimbursement for hotels, convening them has been difficult. So often convening by teleconference, beyond those kind of initial pushes that we had with the whole group. And teleconference, you know, it's not going to be as valuable as in person. So an inspiring group, but also some frustration there. So the scope of our work and our strategy, without a larger budget, don't be confused by this slide. We did not hold town halls across the state. And we really had to leverage Michelle's team. We are largely, as we know from our work on veterans and other military issues, we are largely a National Guard state. So we were able to tap in centrally to the military family program through the Guard, but a challenge to reach into the hinterlands of Oregon to really get an insight from the broad cross-section of our military families. No one center of gravity that we could tap into. Very rural, the size of our state, our small military population to begin with, just a very diffuse population to try to target. So we quickly landed on using the power of the internet to try to get our group in front of as many people as possible to try to capture their insight to both inform the legislature and the governor's future efforts. So with our with ODBA's public affairs team and with the National Guard support, really made a web presence both through Facebook, its own military family task force website, pushed through Vets News on Facebook, both a large push for the online, what was a survey component to the task force effort. So out of that survey that we pushed out, for the data collected, questions that identified characteristics of the respondents and their military experiences, trying to get a sense of who's actually responding, and then very open-ended questions asking what they believed were the issues that needed addressing within the veteran and military families communities. So our total participation, 323. So again, this is not a scientific survey by any means, but gives us a good kind of a focus group from the military family's perspective. It's both spouses, veterans, current service members, children, parents, siblings, other relatives, friends. About 44% were female, 56% were male, average age 49, and again the total participants 323. The total participation by county, similar to what we've seen in some of our other work, the population is in the valley and in the main cities and population centers, but also in our rural communities, we know our veterans and military families make up a much larger percentage of the rural counties. So really a spread across the state in terms of county participation, but also Washington, Marion, Clackamas, some of the larger population areas with better penetration. So in terms of family support and living area, about 36% of the respondents were rural, 64% urban. Most, you know, between the 44% and 26%, most of them have some family that are living nearby, but still about a third that don't have that base of family support in the area. Financial status, most of, you know, about 10-12% identified that they did not have sufficient income. We're having challenges on the financial side. 38% were comfortable and 49% adequate. In terms of seeking employment, we had 81% not seeking employment, but about 20% seeking employment. And this slide gives a picture across the active duty, the National Guard, the Reserves, all branches, and both on the officer side and enlisted side. Gives you a breakdown of the participants. Amazingly, on the deployment side, 85% of the respondents have deployed or had a family member or deployed themselves to a combat zone. 70% have deployed since 2001. Almost half have deployed more than four times, which is a pretty amazing statistic. That on-again, off-again nature is a tremendous wear and tear on our military forces and on, obviously, our military families. About one in five have sustained wounds from their service, and 2% have died and made the ultimate sacrifice during their service. This gives a picture of, in terms of requesting our services, about 20% were contacted by the rear detachment, whether from the Guard, the Reserves, the active duty. About three quarters have requested services, and that really runs the gamut from family readiness with Michelle's programs, from Veterans Affairs, both at the county, state, and federal level, from other organizations, our nonprofits, support organizations, and then about a little over a quarter not requesting any services. And those services really run the gamut. I was surprised by how low the child care number was, and I think with a broader, more scientific survey, we'd see child care rocket a little bit higher, I think.
Absolutely.
As one of the top concerns for military families, especially during deployments. No surprise that employment was high with 27%. Mental health called out, and it's not just mental health on the veteran side, but kind of the secondary impacts on the military families, again, for the spouses, for the children. It's an off-radar. Mental health is a challenging issue to address just for our veterans, but that much kind of a further removed, deeper look at mental health for the military families. Healthcare, financial challenges with 38%. And then just a kind of, did they find the resources easily? We have a lot of, it's always the challenge of what are the resources, where are the military families and veterans, and then connecting them. About half are finding the resources easily, but still about 20% did not feel supported during their service. So still a lot of work that we need to do both across our core programs and with our partners to reach that to reach that group. So the key issues, and so then we also had kind of a breakout paragraph section, not multiple choice, that allowed them to highlight where they thought the main issues were. And overarching, it was a lack of military community support network. I think that speaks to kind of our Fort Oregon model. We don't have one main base that's a center of gravity. How do we build that? You know, less than 1% are serving. How do we build that community support for our military families when it is not on the radar day-to-day in necessarily all of our communities? Mental health, counseling services, both for service members, the veterans, their children, and their spouses, called out as another top-tier issue. And then difficulty finding resources to assist the family through emergency or transitional life events. That transition period, whether you're getting out of the military during deployments, before deployments, post-deployments, during deployments, those are the key places where we need to target our core programs and our support. Again, such one of the frustrations, you know, this is a population that has diverse needs across so many areas. So much came out in the survey in terms of community support. It might be some help mowing the lawn. It might be financial support. It might just being able to share your story. Really trying to find a way that we can highlight that community support and better tap in to that Fort Oregon model. Mental health resources, again, post-traumatic stress for our veterans and military service members. Those are often going to rise to the top, often finding our spouses and our military family seeing those issues first, and then also making sure that we've got counseling resources for the military families themselves. And then again, the transitional and emergency services. A lot of the programs that we see, whether through the Guard or the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs or through our nonprofit partners, often it's one-time assistance that kind of gets you through an immediate crisis but does not sustain the financial support during these transitional periods. I mean, there's threats of homelessness from as they transition out of the military, and often those one-time grants are not enough right now. And sometimes where their income was such a level that they were exempted and not eligible for some of the financial assistance that we do have. Out of this group, kind of going back to that, these are real, the folks that we've had on this task force are real people with real lives. They did not always, their experience did not always lend to making a policy recommendation in terms of programmatic or core legislative or core budget recommendations. But I think there's some powerful lessons for us to learn. and we'll hear from Michelle in a little bit talking about the family program, really leveraging their experience through the National Guard is going to be key to our success. Between the military department and ODVA, we provide some of the core programs for our veterans and military families. And I think one of the credit to Michelle, we always focus on the service members and the veterans, and through her leadership we now always include families in that conversation. And if we're going to be successful with having veterans and our service members thrive in the state of Oregon, it's going to be when we're also doing the outreach and education to their family members. So we need to drive that family perspective into every one of our core programs that are supporting our veterans and service members. But it's also going to be a broader conversation about how do we get those broader partners, whether other state agencies, whether the counties, up to the feds, out to the tribes, our nonprofits, our business community, our education providers, our healthcare providers, boggles the minds in terms of the diffuse or the many issues that our military families are facing. And I think it's incumbent on the military department and ODVA to provide that convening authority and leadership through that joining community forces model and really strengthen that, knowing that together we are stronger. In that joining community forces model, it's not necessarily that we need new programs at military department or at ODVA. There's a lot of concerns as the wars wind down and as we get out of Afghanistan with the majority of our troops in 2014, that we potentially lose some of the funding sources, not for Michelle's family program, which has kind of been a long-standing program through the Guard, but potentially on the reintegration team and that peer-to-peer model. But looking at how do we structure and staff ourselves, both at military department and ODVA, that we are a convener and leading on building that awareness and strengthening the partnerships. So looking at what we can do on training, not just on education for our veterans and military families, but building that military culture and veterans culture awareness in all of our different agencies and partners. And then how do we strengthen the local networks, the vet nets, the military support networks at the local county and regional level, knowing that what works in Lake Oswego may be very different from what works in Lakeview. But it's really going to run the gamut. There's been some great military family efforts, starting at the top with Vice President Biden's wife and the President Obama's wife, Michelle Obama. And they've really called out amazing partnerships. It's both family, friends, and neighbors. It's the military families themselves getting educated about what the resources are that's out there for them. How do we tap into our educators, our healthcare professionals, the folks serving our children and youth, the community civic and religious leaders? How do our foundations play? Our employers looking at flex schedules, employing military spouses, having support groups, our state and local government officials, federal government and military leaders. So many different pots that we can tap into to drive good works for our military families. And one that I want to call out, I think that we've had consideration for in the past, the Military Families Education Compact that Oregon has not signed up for yet, and I think is a great bill to consider, and we'll have the Department of Defense, Mark Sanssouci, helping us advise on that legislation. And I think a really good one to call out our military children in our educational facilities. It's not going to be an automatic for teachers and principals and school counselors to think that some of the issues of our children may be because of a deployment or because of our military family stresses. So raising the awareness within that education compact could be a good bill going forward in February. But want to give Michelle just a chance to highlight her program at the Guard, and then also happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair Fagan, Madam Vice Chair Parrish, my name is Michelle Kachowski, the State Family Program Director for the Oregon National Guard. So Cam is a hard act to follow. Let me start with that. So it's a good thing we're partners in this. So one thing that I just wanted to really bring up is the continuing programs that we offer. And Representative Parrish, you know best that it's a moving target for what our families need. And what that family needs changes based upon what their current needs are. So a city state family who has a service member in that 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks a year drill status, their needs are obviously very different from our 41st Brigade family members who are getting ready to have a service member gone for a year. So the point of our programs and services is to help our families be whole families before they encounter that military service. So we do a lot of steady state programming, so before they're even on the bubble to deploy, We work on their financial readiness, their family readiness, making sure they understand their benefits, and then also reminding them of all of the benefits that come from being a military family, whether or not you're headed to a combat zone or on a deployment. One of the other big things that we've started since the 5 years I've been the family program director is we actually reach out to our service members and families when they first join the military. So it's the recruit sustainment program. So when a service member has decided they're going to join, they go to the one weekend a month drill, and they get ready before they even ship to basic training. That program has helped a lot get our family members and our service members off on the right foot of what to expect and also where to go for resources. It's proven to improve our retention rates, our ship rates to basic training, and then just, again, getting them set up for the right way of being a military family. One of the other big pieces that we've really worked on and through this task force that has come through is educating our community partners that you don't always have to have a separate program for a military program, but just identifying sometimes that they are a military-connected family. And that's the other big phrase that we're trying to, as Cameron said, we've worked on having service members and family, people saying, and families. I actually had a boss that used to pick on me because he would say service members, and I would say, and families. Like, when you're not home, there's someone that misses you while you're gone, whether it's your spouse, your parent, your sibling, your next-door neighbor, the person who pets at your goldfish, somebody misses that service member while they're gone. So the other thing we're working on is getting a lot of our community partners just to ask the question, are you a military-connected family? So the schools are a big one we're working on. A lot of community resources through the Service Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the SAMHSA project that Cameron and my boss, Chaplain Larkin, co-lead, is just getting a lot of people to ask that question because it provides another level of awareness. And then also, if they're serving the service member, to ask what their family needs. And so we're just trying to make it more of a whole family approach. And as we both, Cameron and I have talked about endlessly, it's not just the service member who serves, it's that family too. So trying to treat the service member, you need to treat their support network and you need to educate them. One of our best people to have interventions for service members are that nagging family member, whether it's the spouse, the parent, the roommate that says, no, really, you got to change this. So the old phrase of mama ain't happy, nobody happy kind of applies in our world too. Because if this family is not happy with the military service, the service member is not that likely to stay in. They do it, but we're just trying to make sure that families understand what they need, and there are a lot of good things that come from being a military family member. And the last thing that I wanted to talk and echo Cameron on is that interstate compact on education. It's a big one. We often miss sometimes how much the kids are impacted, and Representative Parrish, I've heard your story several times of your children during Mark's service, Colonel Parrish's service. So just another part of it that we can help. And also to our steady state folks, we have a lot of active guard reservists from various components, the Navy Reserve, the National Guard, that move, not necessarily as the active duty do, but they still have an impact and change. And if you're talking a kid in school, moving during the school year is tough. Moving when you're in high school is even tougher for some of those. So just to echo Cameron, there's some easy ways to make some benefits to our military families that are alive and well in this state, simple things that can make their life and service a little bit easier. So if Cameron, I think one other thing that I'd like to do is recognize Barbara Feldy, who's the co-chair on our task force, is here with us too. She's with us today in the audience. I just want to recognize her for coming and attending. So with that, I yield back to Cameron and any questions.
We're happy to take any questions.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the informative hearing. And when my brother was deployed, I was in high school, and I certainly in a little town in Wasco County, and certainly remember just the stresses that comes along with it. You can't necessarily talk to your friends about if they don't have a family member deployed. So,
and thank you for your service because you were impacted for sure, ma'am. Sorry.
Thank you very much. Sure. Do we have any questions? Yes, Representative Parrish.
So a couple things. Cameron, any word on, you know, the potential deployment for 2014 would be the first question. And the kind of follow-up is if we are kind of still in that queue and looking at that, what is currently being done to kind of strengthen family programs? And of particular concern to me is, you know, what was on the books in 2009-10 for that deployment where family programs had no funding. So, you know, they can't be a nonprofit. They can't go out and ask for funds. So what are we doing to try to maybe bolster family support given the kind of strange, you know, kind of federal rules around money for family programs? We want those programs to be robust, and yet we don't fund them and we don't encourage them to go seek funding. And then the community sometimes does or doesn't know that they need support. I mean, Hillsborough Rotary has been fantastic for the 41st, and particularly supporting the Forest Grove folks, I think in the last deployment, they raised about $20,000 for mm-hmm. family support mm-hmm. and for programs, but I think that's an anomaly. And so how do we make sure that those are robust moving forward if our, you know, if our troops are in the queue again for 2014?
So Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee, the 41st Brigade had that large deployment in 2009 to Iraq, a very similar type mission as we wind down the war in Afghanistan. Still uncertain, I think, in terms of what that total numbers will be, in terms of whether it will be as large in terms of the whole 41st Brigade. They've off-ramped a few of those smaller companies, but still is holding steady. And even today, a lot of discussions at the national level and in Afghanistan, what will be that continuing presence even beyond 2014, still having potentially a core group that we didn't have in Iraq, 6,000, 9,000 soldiers potentially longer term to secure the region. I think that, that deployment, and I think I'll turn over so a little bit of uncertainty, and I'll turn over to Michelle, of how we use our targeted resources that we do have, largely federally funded in terms of the family program efforts, but how do we target those specifically to the units that will be most impacted by that deployment? They've got a focused plan.
Sure. So Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish committee members, to answer your question, a couple of key points there, Representative Parrish. Certainly you've lived through it with us. I was very new on the job at that point. I think when I started in this job, we were in the midst of starting to process people for the deployment. So I'd like to say that we've come a long way in the 5 years. To particular questions that you talked about, the strengthening of families, which is of course my focus. As I've said, I really believe that in order to make families whole prior to encountering a military separation goes a long way rather than trying to solve crises that have occurred. So the stronger families are. To that point, we are actually starting, so the brigade is set to start their first unit to leave in June. We actually have our first Yellow Ribbon event in January, 3 and 4, and we actually have 14 Yellow Ribbon events that we will be doing across the state. Part of that, so the Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program was a national defense authorization, and it provides funding to units specifically for encountering a deployment. So it's come a long way, I guess is my simple way in saying it. So if a family member is having to travel over a certain distance to attend the events, we actually put them on invitational travel orders. We actually pay for child care now, licensed child care. We actually have curriculum during those child care activities. We have three child and youth coordinators within my team that actually talk about what it means dad's going to be gone, mom's going to be gone, another big one that we've been encountering now. Dad left at home with three teenage girls. It's a real life change for that family on so many occasions. One of my favorite stories to sidestep was a service member of the 1249th whose husband was left home to choose a prom dress, and she put on her Facebook page, "Oh, please, someone go shopping. I'm worried." Mm-hmm. So do those things, right, trying to make the real situations better for families. So we're starting early in making sure they understand their benefits. Our families will actually have the option to attend two Yellow Ribbon events before they even leave. So if you're in the case of your families that have already been through it, you have a track to choose from. So if you're the brand new service member, married, new baby, and need to understand how combat pay works, you get to choose this track. If you're a little bit more seasoned, maybe you're an active guard reservist and you don't need to know how TRICARE works because you got that down, you get to choose this track. So it's more customized training for our families. The other thing that we're incorporating that we talked about in one of our legislative briefs yesterday was the incorporation of events. We're actually doing the marriage enrichment retreats during that same time. So let's say you are, you know, Cameron and I have been military families for a while. You don't necessarily need to understand how the TRICARE works and you already know how the pay works. So you can go to a Strong Bonds event during that time to work on your marriage or attend a Franklin Covey training so it's more whole family. And those are all funded. That is all free to families. If you're from a certain distance, we pay your overnight lodging. We pay you the travel reimbursement that you'd get as a regular federal employee or employee to travel. And then we also bring your kids. That's another big one for our families, that their kids are on site with them. And again, they're getting the education and training of what they're going through. And it's not child care. It is youth activities. We like to make a big distinction there. Even the little kids do some handprints. We do that, make it real for the kids. During the deployment, to your comment to Representative Parrish, is we also have funding to do those during deployment. Events. So we're working on a lot of resilience training. That's a big item for us, and there's a lot we can do for families. And back to the being able to, I don't say commiserate, just relate to somebody that's gone through it, to your point, Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Fagan, sorry, of the being able to talk to somebody else about it, and that's a big thing our families really need to know. Sometimes it's not having someone tell you, I'm so sorry your husband is deployed. I don't need the sorry. I need someone that says, hey, I'm having a really tough day because I really wish he was here. I really wish my brother were here for Christmas. Yep, you're right, that's tough. And it's the relation. You don't need the empathy. You need the empathy, not the sympathy. You don't need the, oh, that's really sad for you. I can't believe your husband put you through that. I didn't ask for that. I asked for someone to say, I'm having a bad Air Force wife day, and someone else to say, I was with you yesterday. I got this for you. So it's that real life connection. So we do those whole family activities during deployment too, and again, back to the kids. We have the youth activities there, and we're using our 4-H partnership. Prior to the return of the service members, we go through the reintegration training. So hopefully 30 to 60 days before they come back, so it'll be next spring, we bring the families back in, and then we talk about and do the concerns, we hear the concerns, we address the post-traumatic stress in a certain way, we talk about the reemployment programs, and we reassure them that they all have these dreams, right? Either positive or negative. They all have these dreams of what it's going to be like coming home, so we do a lot more education. So back to all of these are paid for. We put them on travel orders. We pay for food. We pay for childcare. We make them as energetic as possible. We're really breaking the mold of sitting in the room. So Representative Parrish on this. We don't put people in the room in the middle of a drill floor and show PowerPoint slides. I have an education degree. That doesn't work for anybody, and adult learners are harder to entertain than anybody else. So it's interactive. It's up. It's moving. We're going to do some challenge courses kind of things with some of the internal things that we have and make them really engaging. To the point of the funding, those are all paid for out of Yellow Ribbon funds, and we are completely funded. As Chaplain Larkin mentioned yesterday, we're one of the few sections that actually got an increase in funding because of the deployment. Specifically to your question about the family readiness groups and the funding, they do have to internally fundraise, but I would like to say that there are a lot more options for federal funding to do those whole family activities, and we're not so reliant upon the traditional family readiness groups during times of deployment to be the answer for everybody. We also have a lot more options for whole family activities with a lot of our partner agencies. So we did a financial readiness day. We included about 8 different financial readiness partners, and it was free to the families. So the network has increased through those and will continue to increase through the joining community forces. So there are still the federal fundraising restrictions, absolutely, but it's a lot more things have been funded that aren't reliant upon that family readiness group anymore. So,
The other piece of the equation is historically, we've had some discretionary funds for emergency services for families, so the light bills being shut off, mm-hmm. food security issues. What do those funds look like? I think those have kind of traditionally mm-hmm. been state funds, if I recall, at least maybe a mix of state and federal. So where are we at with those types of funds, and is there a need to fill there?
So Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee, certainly state funds, general fund going into ODVA's emergency assistance program, more focused on the veteran side than more broadly on the military family side, but about $300,000, I think, per biennium, and we divvy that up quarter by quarter, but goes very quickly, is that one-time funding that can get someone that has a car broken down or has a roof leaking or has a utility issue, kind of that flexible funds. But something, to your point on the foundation side, something that we haven't leveraged. We've leveraged a lot of good donations for our veterans home model, and we're trying to move that direction on suicide prevention, on broader financial assistance, but an area that we can grow kind of from that fundraising side. On the guard side, I believe, I think there's state dollars going into the Guard's Emergency Assistance Fund, and I think heavily reliant on organizations like the National Guard Association, more of a nonprofit model within the Guard, and potentially some federal funds that may be flexible, but not as much. So that has been a pressure and a challenge, but one I think that we can advocate for both through the budget process and getting more creative in terms of tapping into the goodwill that does exist out there in our citizens that sometimes does not get channeled effectively at a high level. And I think both for of our Vice Chairs Fagan and Vice Chair Parrish, I hope that Michelle does not live in your district, because I think we should run her for office, given all the hard work she has done. and a pretty robust program that you guys just heard about through the National Guard, and similarly with Chaplain Larkin's leadership, both on the family program and on that reintegration side. We have learned so much from when these wars first kicked off and first had folks going to Iraq and Afghanistan in 2003. But as those wars wind down, have the early conversations now, both between the Guard and ODVA, knowing that the impacts don't always show up that first month, the first 6 months, the first year. Sometimes these challenges for our military families and veterans show up 2 years, 3 years, 5 years hence. So let's keep those conversations going, both on funding and structure now, before we inevitably do lose some of that federal funding that has been not so much on the family program losing it, which I think we'll maintain, hopefully, but definitely on the reintegration team side. It has always been year to year, and it feels like eventually that federal funding will dry up.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. This is something that I think we could probably hear about for a full couple of hours. So great work, and thank you guys very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. And next we get to hear on another great program that on a House Bill 2417 that we passed in 2013, an update on the housing assistance for veterans. And we'll invite up Ryan Fisher and Ben Prey. And we have about 10 minutes for the update. So if you could maybe keep your comments to about 3 minutes and then leave time for questions, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Housing Authorities, which is the statewide association of housing authorities, and Community Action Partnership of Oregon, the statewide association of community action agencies. Very happy to be here in front of this committee again, and especially for the reason, which is to give you an update on how the bill which passed last session is doing. Quickly, I want to just remind you what this bill does, which is it creates an ongoing dedicated revenue source to support low-income veterans finding stable supported housing, or stable housing. And the way that the bill is structured is it builds on an existing document recording fee and adds $5 to that document recording fee, all of which is dedicated to serving veterans. That document recording fee basically breaks down into three buckets, as I like to call it. One is the emergency housing account, which is a funding stream which serves people who are either homeless or at risk of homeless through case management, through rent assistance, and other really critical services that help people that are really in those desperate situations. 10% of the document recording fee goes to that. 14% goes to supporting home ownership, and 76% goes to developing affordable rental housing. And this is a really critical piece of the puzzle. There has to be a place, a permanent place where people can go and transition to and to live that is affordable and that they can stay at in an ongoing place, not just transitional. So I'll let the department, Ben Prey here, talk a little bit about the timeline, but the big news is that this bill's implementation date is January 1, and so the funds will begin being collected on January 1. It'll take some time for them to be collected and dispersed. But in the meantime, I just want to report from an advocate's perspective that we're pleased that the department has brought together a really good group of folks to advise them on how to implement this. There are veterans in that group. There are community service providers. Department of Veterans Affairs has been invited into that group, and we've met to have some discussions. They took that input. They're going to come back to get more input. I think there have been some free-flowing question and answers, phone calls going as people are working on stuff. I'm hearing from people who are getting questions from the department, and we know that that's a good sign. Our goal is to ensure that these funds are rolled out in a way that that allows us to make sure that we're keeping our promise to you, which is that all of these funds are serving veterans, and that also the way that these veterans are being served is as efficiently and effectively as possible. And so that has been the goal of the conversations that we've been having. One thing that we talked about in this committee is that this is not creating new programs. This is building onto existing programs. And so we don't want a lot of these funds going to inventing new programs that have a lot of administrative cost. If there's an opportunity to be able to utilize infrastructure that's already in place and serve veterans through programs that we already have. And so while there are some cases where there are some opportunities to do some new and creative things, it will still be built into an infrastructure that already exists. So as we look forward, one thing that we're most excited about is what I talked about at the beginning, those emergency housing account dollars, the ones that affect folks that are homeless or at risk of homelessness. This is a crisis issue in our country right now when it comes to veterans. Whether we're talking about Vietnam-era veterans who are at a place where they're getting health concerns and are having trouble maintaining their lifestyle, or we're talking about younger folks that are coming back from conflicts right now that are seeing a host of conditions that are making housing a very difficult resource for them. These EHA dollars are important, and the good news is that those are going to be the first ones to hit the ground and to be able to get implemented. All of these things, and we've talked about this in our stakeholder meetings, are going to help make Oregon more competitive for certain grants that the federal VA is offering. They're going to be able to help leverage some of those funds, and they're going to be able to work with those funds. We've talked a lot in this committee, I know, about the VA supportive housing vouchers, the VASH vouchers, and sometimes it's hard. A veteran will get that voucher, but without $1,000 was the average that it took to be able to help a veteran be able to use that voucher. First and last month's rent, security deposit, transportation to be able to go look at a place to live. Without those flexible funds, that VASH voucher could be worthless to the veteran if they can't find a place to live. And those EHA dollars are the kind of dollars that can help them use those VASH vouchers. So we're very grateful to this committee for your leadership on this bill. This is the committee that brought this bill to the legislature. You're the ones who sent it forward. It went through, I think, four other committees after yours. It was a long process, but I really want to thank this committee for your leadership on this issue, and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks, Ben.
Sure. Vice Chair Fagan and Parrish and members of the committee, I'm Ben Prey with Oregon Housing. I think I can keep my piece pretty short because we don't have a lot to report. Mm-hmm. We're really in the planning process. I think, you know, the headline here is that we're the housing department and we have good experience and expertise for delivering the doc recording fee funds. But, you know, the expertise for veterans is obviously with the ODBA and the partners and folks like Ryan in the state. So we're in the planning process. We're listening as much as possible. We're trying not to duplicate programs. We're trying to, you know, augment programs that are already existing or make them better, if at all possible. Provided a little spreadsheet here that shows each of the funding streams, and don't have to go into great detail, but as Ryan mentioned, the first sort of bucket that's going to hit the ground is EHA. That's going to be about $100,000 per quarter of additional funds. These are just projections from our department, but so that should help fairly quickly. The second category is homeownership assistance program. Those are a little bit more flexible, and there's some exciting opportunities to work with veterans and advocates across the state to find out what's the smartest way we can apply those funds and where are those really needed. But the final one and the biggest piece of the puzzle is 76% is for multifamily development, and I think we're all in agreement that we need to wait until those funds accrue so there's enough to fund projects through the multifamily NOFA process that we use at the department. So I think for now we're excited to be working with ODBA and all the folks we brought together, and I think we'll have more to report in February or whenever we're asked to report on what the new programs are going to look like. So happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So help me understand the disbursement model that's going to be applied to this. You know, I appreciate that big counties, and I live in one of the big counties, you know, population-wise, tend to suck up the lion's share of these types of funds. So is there some kind of mechanism in place to ensure that, you know, $5 doesn't go to Curry County, or, you know, some number that is makes no sense that they actually can't do anything with the money because the number's so low, and yet they still have real needs that need to be addressed? I mean, I know Clackamas County is very appreciative of, you know, any dollars you send their way, but, you know, I think we saw in a committee yesterday where, you know, something we tried to implement had a really negative outcome for small counties that we're going to have to come back and fix. And so want to just be certain that enough of those funds to make an actual difference get out to those rural areas.
Thank you. It's a great question. And so I'm familiar with how the emergency housing account is distributed because it does go through the Community Action Network typically. And there are floors for smaller regions in the Community Action Network. There are 18 community action agencies around the state, and they cover every county in the state. Obviously, some of them are covering multiple counties, particularly in Eastern Oregon. You have some that are two or three counties per community action agency. The emergency housing account is already a general fund item, although it's something that we would like to see be a lot bigger than it is. And there are some other document recording fees. And so all of those are coming together to those community action agencies. The portion that is going to them for veterans, it will be smaller than, of course, we would like, but it won't restrict in a way that you're talking about in terms of an issue where you might describe with the program with the counties, because it's coming with these other emergency housing account dollars. And so these are going to be able to go into places where there are already programs intact. They don't need operating fees in order to get this thing up and running. This is going to be dollars for services that they're already providing that will be available specifically for veterans, and they will be new funds on top of what they've been using currently.
Thank you.
And Vice Chair Parrish and members of the committee, I'd add that for the other pieces, you know, our department is sensitive to the need to distribute funds as best possible regionally throughout the state with our funding process for the notice for our multifamily developments and even hardest hit funds where we have county by county expectations that those dollars are going to spread across the state. So as we plan the process with our partners, we'll continue to be sensitive to that.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Wonderful. Well, thank you for the update, and we'll look forward to hearing more when the funds actually start being collected and dispersed.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Next, we have a very brief informational hearing on in-state tuition for veterans, House Bill 2158. So call up Joe Holliday and Gus Bedwell. Good morning. Go ahead and introduce yourself and get started.
Good morning, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I serve the Oregon University system as Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Success Initiatives, and I'm here to briefly report on the implementation of House Bill 2158, and Gus Bedwell from Oregon State University is here and had something to say about that as well, and he has a larger report that you have an electronic version of, at least I know. If time permitted, I realize you're on a tight schedule, but I did want to ask Gus to be here. Oregon State University really sets the bar for how to serve veterans in our universities, and Gus has done a fantastic job, and so there's a lot to learn from what they're doing. So we implemented House Bill 2158 this fall term. House Bill 2158 changed two statutes, one that had initially created a discount of non-resident veteran tuition in 2009 and then made it resident tuition, and then the other statute that changed was the one that created our veterans dependent tuition waiver and added children of Oregon Purple Heart recipients to the list of eligible dependents for that benefit. And so we implemented both. They're for new students only, as us who began school on September 15th this year or later. That's one of the issues Gus wanted to talk about a little bit based on his experience on the ground at Oregon State. We have 70 students, new students, who have taken advantage of this benefit system-wide already. That's an unofficial number, but we think we're pretty close. They're distributed at six of our seven universities. Portland State, Oregon State, University of Oregon have the largest number of them. One of the things we were concerned about was that even though the benefit was limited to new students for fiscal reasons, there was a potential loophole, if you will, that a student could look at that and there would be nothing to stop them from transferring from one university to another to be a new student at that other university, which may or may not be a good thing. It might be disruptive to the student and to the university that they're leaving. Might be a good thing, so it could go either way. We haven't seen much of that activity, but Gus did want to comment a little bit on that particular part of the bill, if that's all right with you.
Great.
So good morning, Vice Chair Fagan and Vice Chair Parrish. Good to be here again to talk on behalf of student veterans in general. As Joe said, my name is Gus Bedwell.
I was just going to tell you to introduce yourself. No problem.
I'm Gus Bedwell. I'm the Veterans Resource Coordinator at Oregon State University. Several things that the students want to convey, but I want to talk a little bit about House Bill 2158. You know, first thing is I want to say we've had some really great responses to this bill. There are several students who are happy to see that Oregon supports them and their education by providing in-state tuition and fees. Unfortunately, at the same time, I've had several students who have expressed their dislike of the language new after September 15, 2013. And, you know, I'll say, even though I'm aware with what talking with Joe on why that language was inserted, I know several Oregon State University students who have come to me and said, hey, we want to talk to somebody about why this was written this way and what we can do to look at that for the future. And several Oregon State University students have said that they would like to have conversations about how this has had a negative impact on their education decisions. And so one thing I would offer is that if you, as you have a chance to go around in the communities, is I would stop by some universities and community colleges and see if you can do some town halls there to talk with some students. In particular, at Oregon State University, we know we have about 13 students that have benefited from this, but we have about 55 students that have not. And so that's a pretty large number to have students that have not benefited from something that, that others have. And so at this time, I have nothing else to say. I'm open for questions or comments.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Okay, so help me out here. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that was brought up when we had the hearings before was that, if I recall right, is that somebody who's in your system, you know, will eventually have in-state tuition because they've, you know, achieved residency. So that doesn't happen?
No. If, go ahead. Go ahead. You want me to
take that? I can certainly take a quick stab at that, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee. To establish residency at an Oregon University system institution, a student needs to be, if they entered the military from Oregon, they do not lose their residency. So that would be one category that we wouldn't be worried about. But if they were not an Oregonian and they came to Oregon post-service but had not established residency by being here a year doing something primarily other than being in school full-time, they would not be a resident. They would have to establish residency.
Can I follow up? Yes. So that was definitely not my intent in 2158. My hope was that come September, all of those veterans mm-hmm. would be wrapped into that. So I guess, do we need to come back and revisit the statute, or is this something that the OUS system can just make an executive decision to say that they're going to honor the spirit and intent of the law and wrap those kids in? I'm happy to try to solve it either way, but I'm just kind of curious if there's anything that precludes you from, you know, making a university-level decision to say we're going to wrap all of those veterans into that tuition bracket.
All right, so Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee, one thing that complicates it is that as of July 1st, three of our universities will have their own boards, and so we cannot act as a system as of July 1st. Four of our universities will, for at least 1 year, remain together, the four small universities, and so that's a possibility there. But so it's more complicated than it has been.
One more follow-up. Yes. So for the remaining OUS schools that are in there, and I appreciate that the small schools are kind of all lumped into that mix, I certainly would be willing to have the conversation with all the new boards when they kick in to do this, because I do not believe it was our intent to leave out existing students. I mean, I think we all wanted to see them wrapped in. So for the ones that it's not necessarily those three boards, can OUS make that decision at those universities? Right now, it looks like Western's got one student, Southern's got six, and, you know, Eastern doesn't have any. So really this, I'm not sure who else is in the mix of that, or I guess Oregon Tech has three. So we're talking about five or six students or seven students to make that decision. We can at least solve that at that campus. And then when the new boards come on at the other three universities, certainly will, I think this body would be interested in reaching out to them to do the same.
Sure. So Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee, I'm not an expert on statutes and how that works, but I believe the statute actually says new students as of September 15th, mm-hmm. 2013.
And just for a clarifying point for me, based on Representative Parrish's question, this number that you gave us, these are the students that are actually
receiving
taking advantage
the
of the
right.
exemption. Oh, this wouldn't be
right.
the
so
number.
This would be a larger number.
Because you had mentioned,
right.
I think, at right. Oregon State, 13 taking advantage, but 55
right.
not.
Right.
So it
right.
looks
we,
like the number that are getting mm-hmm. excluded would actually be
Probably maybe two or three times bigger than this, okay.
It's at Oregon State University in particular, that is true. I cannot speak for other universities. The only reason I have the number is because I wanted to do the research. I wanted to be ahead of the situation, mm-hmm. to have answers for students, to have other financial determining factors, to be able to help the students. I mean, it's very difficult for me as a Veterans Resource Coordinator to tell somebody who their first term was summer term, right, that starting fall term, that because they're already a student at OSU, that this bill does not apply to them. And fortunately for us, though, we are still a great state, and we still have the non-resident veterans remission tuition program. And Oregon State University has done a great job at looking at how to maximize the Yellow Ribbon program for our undergraduate students as well. And so the cost out of pocket is not huge, but it's still something where there's been definitely some comments. Probably the biggest comment from students.
Okay, great. Good to know. Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Joe, does any of this have to do with what we had to negotiate down to keep the fiscal? Because some of the earliest proposal was going to have a huge fiscal.
Sure. Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Rep. Huffman, Rep. Witt. That's correct. I was involved in the work on the bill as it changed and the work with the Senate, and we were told that we had to begin with the assumption of minimal fiscal impact, and so that's why it was written that way.
If I remember correctly, though, the initial fiscal was also based on looping in online ed, and so I think that was something that also made the initial fiscal so big, so I don't know that it was particularly the date that was going to make the fiscal larger. I think that was the bigger piece that affected the fiscal impact, was the online part. So we still might be able to fix this without, blowing up the fiscal to the point where it has a hard time getting through the building. I've certainly got a bill left for February if I could do a broad relating to clause, just relating to veterans, and we could work on this, unless the chair wants to do it as a committee bill. Any other questions? Great. Well, thank you for the update, but particularly thank you for bringing this issue to our attention, because I agree with Representative Parrish. We certainly didn't have the intent of, making it where a student who simply started school previously as opposed to this year would be paying a very different tuition than his or her peers. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So we probably didn't get a chance to catch that on our side because the process, we moved it out of the
right.
house. Then it got played with it.
Right.
It probably went down to Ways and Means. It never came back to our committee
right.
to,
right.
get that. So.
Welcome. It looks like we have a new group of folks coming in to observe. So welcome to the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. And so our final hearing is on an update on House Bill 3207 from 2011, the job interviews for veterans. Looks like we're going to have two separate panels. So first I'll call up Sarah Miller and Jeff Burgess for the Training Public Employers. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for state government, but I'm here today in my double duty capacity as the Acting Chief Human Resource Officer for state government, and providing the update on behalf of the Department of Administrative Services and the CHRO, which has responsibility for interpretation of statewide personnel law and policy. In February of 2012, the department implemented an update to our state's HR system, which allows for tracking of state employee veteran status. And so we have been doing work with existing state employees to update their veteran status on a self-report basis. We also added to our voluntary questionnaire as part of our recruitment process, self-reporting, self-identification of both veteran status and disability status, which lets us have information available to us about our candidates who want jobs in Oregon state government. I'm happy to report to you that since March of 2012, the state has hired just under 10% of its entire new hires have been veterans, so about 978 veterans since March of 2012. With regards to House Bill 3207. The department has worked extensively with public sector human resource directors, both inside of state government and with local government, to implement 3207. We provide training to state agency recruiters, both in a large group, and then we provide consultation one-on-one throughout the year on how to apply the law. Though these efforts have primarily been focused in state government, which is our purview, we did partner with Director Smith's department, Veterans Affairs, to provide a training to local government recruiters as well about how the state has applied the law. The committee assistant asked us to come prepared to offer some ideas for how the law might be clarified in the future, and so the remainder of my testimony is relative to a policy problem that we think exists. So I think everyone agrees on about 75% of the law as drafted. Veterans are offered an interview when their experience meets minimum qualifications or special qualifications of a job posting. We refer to these in the state government hiring process as required skills. So when a state agency posts a job, there are minimum qualifications for that position. In certain cases, there are special requirements. We call those required skills. We use a term in state government called desired attributes, which is that set of criteria above minimum qualifications and special qualifications, which helps us narrow our pool based on fit, right? So you've met a minimum threshold, then we look at the set of desired attributes to determine who should be interviewed. We think of them as requested skills. It's my understanding, having not been involved with the law when it was drafted or modified, that instead of using desired attributes, which is state government language, we changed the language to reflect requested skills because that was more appropriate to all public sector hiring processes. But to put it plainly, agencies must offer interviews to veteran applicants who are competitive with if they're background and experience. They're provided preference points in a uniform way, both in scored and unscored hiring processes, and that's pretty consistent. The place where I think not all of the 92 state agencies operate exactly consistently is the application of the experience to the desired attributes. And so some agencies believe that they only have to offer a veteran an interview if they have met the minimum qualifications and special qualifications and desired attributes. Some people believe if a veteran has met minimum qualifications and special qualifications but may not score very well against the desired attributes, they need to also be offered an interview. Certainly the department is interested in clarification around that particular part of the law, because frankly the state's at risk of lawsuits, and in fact I got notice from my trial attorney yesterday that we are engaged in a lawsuit that a veteran is bringing against the state, believing that he was not treated consistently in hiring processes across multiple state agencies as it involves this issue. So clearly as a practical matter, we aren't consistent across the enterprise of state government in the application of this particular piece. But certainly my co-panelist from the Bureau of Labor and Industries has been doing training as well and can speak from his perspective. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. I'm glad someone from BOLI is here, because I just wrote down, is this an OAR or ORS issue? So I bet you can answer that question.
I will never do so. Good morning, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee. I'm Jeff Burgess from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Technical Assistance for Employers Program, BOLI TA for short. And TA provides services to employers when they have questions about the application of state and federal employment law in the workplace. In doing so, we answer telephone and email inquiries, somewhere between 16 and 20,000 of those a year. And we do that at no charge. We write newspaper columns on topics of interest. We put on seminars. We publish handbooks and issue fact sheets and answer frequently asked questions on our website. Our unit consists of 6 persons, so we keep pretty busy. We scrupulously refrain from giving legal advice or making business decisions for employers, but we try to give them information so that they can make good employment decisions going forward and minimize their exposure to liability. So our approach is designed to take care not to suggest risky courses of action. As recent changes to Oregon's veterans preference laws in public hiring and in promotions have come about, including House Bill 3207, we've conducted seminars for public employers, written columns and fact sheets, and answered many inquiries from employers to provide some guidance to them. And in doing so, we have endeavored to adhere to the plain language of the statutes and the rules. Boley's interpretation of House Bill 3207 is that it requires employers to interview all veterans. And to answer your question, Vice Chair Fagan, this is, in our view, a function of statutory interpretation and not rule making or rule interpretation. All veterans who meet the minimum and any special qualifications and who show evidence of transferable skills required or requested by the public employer. We believe that our materials, our trainings, and our writings are consistent with the plain language of the law. Veterans who meet these criteria should be interviewed in keeping with the law. However, if our interpretation of the legislation is not what the legislature intended, clarification would certainly be helpful.
Great.
So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to
Thank answer. You. Any questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, you know, we're having this hearing because I heard from somebody who works in employment division, field person, who said, and a former veteran, I'm sorry, not former, former National Guard, currently a veteran, who really felt like this is not being applied consistently, had talked to veterans, you know, who said, hey, I thought we had a law that would let me have this. So I think this, you know, and Representative Witt certainly was our chair at that, and we can both, I think, speak to the intent behind that. In my interpretation, the intent was if they have, you know, skills, and some of the debate in 2011 was, you know, just, do we, you know, does the city government have to, you know, give every veteran an interview? And we said no. We said, you know, meet the minimum qualifications, have, you know, the skills, or be able to, you know, in the application process, at least, you know, have a mechanism for them to say, you know, this job in the military equals, you know, some skills that would transfer. And we wanted to have some discretion, I think, a little bit for cities and counties to interpret that, but it sounds like we need to maybe tighten that up, and I'm willing to, you know, Rep. Witt, do you have thoughts on that? I mean, that's what I recall from those hearings. And
Madam Chair?
Oh, please, yeah.
It is, Representative Parrish, my recollection is exactly as you've characterized it. It was an effort on the part of the committee and then subsequently the legislature to extend an opportunity to veterans who may be disadvantaged for a host of reasons in a public hirings process, to afford them the opportunity to at least demonstrate the skills, the life skills perhaps, that they have acquired through military service and elsewhere, to be able to demonstrate that through an interview process. The criteria, again, as Representative Parrish has stated, I think was meet the minimum requirements, and then be able to establish that at some place in the course of their lives that they would have a requisite set of skills and knowledge to make them a competent employee. There was no sense that they necessarily had to be in the top 5%, 20%, or whatever of the group of the selected group for an interview, but rather that they established the background and then get the interview as a result of that.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Representative Witt, from my perspective, I think we're consistent in state government to about three quarters of that. The place where really I think it is gray and not consistently applied, and keep in mind, right, each individual state agency for the most part has their own hiring process that has to be compliant with Department of Administrative rules and policies, but gets executed as individual hiring decisions. The place where I think it's not clear, at least in state government, and that's my purview today. I can't speak to a local government perspective, is the application of desired attributes as part of that demonstration of skill, right? And so I think the clarification that could be offered might be as simple as to use a definition of requested skill for Oregon state government equals desired attributes, and then the consistent treatment of veterans' applications in scored and unscored processes. Everybody understands that rule set, right? I think the piece that is not clear is, do desired attributes really count as requested skills that have to be part of the evidence provided by the veteran applicant in order to be given the preferential scoring? And if that piece could be clarified, then we wouldn't have any disagreement.
Do you think that's something that could be clarified that needs to be a statutory change, or could Bowley engage in some rulemaking that made that more clear?
Thank you, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, members of the committee. It's unclear to me whether House Bill 3207 gives Bowley the statutory authority to engage in that kind of rulemaking, which would insert a new concept, desired attributes, into this matrix of considerations that employers are undertaking to comply with the Veterans Preference Law. And so the word desired attributes doesn't appear anywhere in the bill, and frankly, we just call them as we see them, and I think our interpretation is consistent with that Representative Witt outlined just a few moments ago. And so respectfully, I think it would be simpler and clearer if that came by way of statute rather than by rulemaking.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think these good folks, as well as their agencies, are attempting to do a very good job in terms of service to the veterans community. They're the ones that have to make this work on a daily basis, and maybe it would be helpful if they provided some suggested language to the committee leadership for our consideration.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Representative Witt, certainly on behalf of the Department of Administrative Services, I've made this commitment to the Deputy Director at Bowley that post this hearing, we'd be happy to get together and talk about where we think there could be some clarification that both agencies could agree to, because certainly no one should interpret from my comments anything other than state government's desire to hire qualified veterans to continue their public service as civil servants after their enlisted or commissioned service. So we're happy to participate in that.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, just a comment. Sarah, you're everywhere.
I apologize for that, I think.
And just the breadth of knowledge that you have to do in your job, I just really appreciate, from healthcare to veterans to, you know, all over the place. So thank you. I appreciate the state's commitment. So it's just more of a comment, you know, the stat around, you know, nearly 1,000 veterans hired since the passage of this. I mean, that's a huge lift in terms of reemployment and hiring, and you know, hopefully we can, the gentleman who has a challenge with the legal piece of this, hopefully we can get that cleaned up for him too. But I really do just appreciate the state's commitment. I'm hoping this is happening also in cities and counties. I don't know that there's a really good way to track that, but I just appreciate your knowledge, and I appreciate, you know, you both coming in and trying to make this work with us. So thank you.
Happy for the opportunity.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for our final informational hearing, we will hear on training veterans from Jim Booker and Chaplain Terry Larkin. And while they're coming up, who do we have with us? Who's this class?
We're from Harvard School of Arts and Sciences.
Which is in my house district.
Oh, very cool. Wonderful. Well, welcome.
That's the school that the Honorable Ben Cannon used to teach at.
Oh, great.
And they're here visiting today, so we'll see you at 10:45. You're my 10:45 appointment, but that's right there in my house district.
Very nice. Well, welcome. Go ahead and begin. Thank you.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Representative Witt.
I'm Chaplain Colonel Terry Larkin. I'm the Director of the Service Member and Family Support Directorate for the Oregon National Guard. On a daily basis, our organization works with Oregon National Guard service members as well as all veterans and their families to provide assistance for their many essential needs and services, including job search in the civilian sector. One of the most important tasks for a service member who's integrating back into the civilian workforce is translating their military skills and experience into civilian language. With our J9 team, we provide the veteran or service member with a two-pronged approach to address this issue. The first of these programs was implemented by the Army and Air Force after Congress passed the Veterans for Opportunity for Work to Hire Heroes in 2011. The active duty Army and Air Force have been providing transition assistance to their service members for many years. However, it wasn't until November of 2011, with the passage of the VOW Act, that all National Guard and Reserve members returning from active duty also had opportunity to participate in these same programs. The second program, Hero to Hire, focuses on assisting National Guard service members who are already looking for employment in the civilian workplace by offering them a comprehensive translation of their military experience and skills into a robust career for their future. My organization, the Oregon National Guard J9, partners with H2H to offer personalized career counseling and job referral skills to anyone who registers with H2H within the state of Oregon. These two initiatives, VOW and H2H, cast a wide net of assistance to every National Guard service member, as well as any Oregon veteran who chooses to take advantage of these programs. Let me talk about them one at a time, if I can. When a National Guard service member has accrued 180 days or more of active duty military service, he or she is required by the VOW Act to participate in the transition process that you see outlined here. Every one of our returning veterans, it goes through this two-day VOW program. For National Guard service members, this program is most often implemented when they're returning from a deployment overseas at a mobilization station. During the redeployment process, service members are guided through this program by trained VOW specialists. Three of these VOW counselors work in our office here in Salem, and they serve as our direct link to this national initiative. As you can see here, in the transition process has six distinct steps. But let me address specifically the third step. The military occupational specialty crosswalks begins by every service member verifying their military experience and training. It's a document we call VMET from a DOD website. The VMET resembles an educational transcript that you might get from a college or another educational institution to list all specialty skills and training that a soldier has received during his career or her career. Service members then decide what type of civilian career they want to consider. VOW specialists guide them through this process by helping them make the decisions based on geographical location, labor market information, and personal preference. The majority of military skill translations happens next on what we call the ONET website. ONET includes a comprehensive online tool that allows service members to specifically translate every one of their military skills onto their VMET in the equivalent civilian skill and occupation. The MOS crosswalk process concludes by the soldiers completing a written gap analysis. The analysis outlines their chosen career field, their civilian equivalents that they already possess, and the skills that they lack for their career goal. And then it identifies a strategy to help that service member do what's necessary to fill that gap. In all, the MOS crosswalk process and the overall transition process provides a very effective tool to National Guard soldiers and airmen who are transitioning from from active duty to civilian world. The other program is our H2H program. While the VAL program focuses on those who are returning from active duty, H2H is designed for somebody who has been deployed or not deployed, and is available to all veterans, not just our National Guard service members. The website and services it provides differs from the VAL program because service members who have already made transition to civilian life and are trying to find employment in the Oregon civilian job market are able to access this program. The H2H website provides listings for more than 3.5 million civilian jobs nationwide. 3.5 million jobs. To effectively begin the search for their career opportunities, H2H guides service members through a career assessment and exploration process that you see summarized here. The first step requires the service to input their military occupational skill, much like with the VAL program, and it sets up in a database those military skills. They're constantly being updated and adjusted for across the military branches, and actually goes all the way back to the first Gulf War. It maps military skills to more than 9,000 civilian skill sets. The next step is for the service member to choose from a list of possible civilian careers that utilize those skill sets that they've identified. H2H will then display for a service member a collection of job opportunities currently available to them in their own geographical location that's related to their skills and their education. The J9 is established in a joint transition assistance program that works hand-in-hand with the H2H program. Once service members have been registered in the H2H software, they are referred to a regional JTAP coordinator or specialist who will personally coach them to be able to make sure that they can land the job they're seeking. These JTAP specialists actively network in local communities and will often be able to connect a service member with a unique job referral that they otherwise would not have been able to find on their own. The partnership between H2H and JTAP is unique to the state of Oregon. There isn't another state in the country that has this unique relationship. The J9 Service Member and Support Group is leading the way nationally with this initiative, and we've gathered national recognition for this program. Both these programs are relatively new and continue to build clients and exposure. For the fiscal year just ended, 2013, there were more than 200 Oregon National Guard soldiers and airmen that attended the VAL transition workshops at the demobilization sites. As we get ready, Representative Parrish, to deploy people next year, we anticipate those numbers going up for the next two fiscal years as well. We're going to have people who are gainfully employed and finding employment. The H2H and JTAP partnership resulted in the direct and indirect hiring of 520 Oregon National Guard soldiers, airmen, and veterans to civilian employment in this last fiscal year, and our goal is 800 new hires for this next year. Currently, the regional JTAP specialists have a caseload of 340 individuals they're coaching through this transition and job search process. In summary, the J9 Service Member and Family Support Director is a leader in providing the Oregon National Guard members with effective military skill translation and services, and is a leading expert in veteran reintegration programs for the state of Oregon. Thank you. And any questions? Vice Chair, Representative Witt?
I think maybe we can hear from our second panelist before.
Good morning, I'm Jim Booker, the Federal Programs Manager for the Oregon Employment Department and an Air Force veteran. I'd like to let you know that the Employment Department is a critical part of veterans getting jobs. We work very closely with the JTAP folks to help veterans navigate the job search system. We're there to help them make that military to civilian transition. We have staff that are specially trained to help them do that. We have a focused job search help direction that we go with our veterans. It includes resume writing, vocational guidance, job referral, connection to education pieces that they might need, apprenticeship programs, and to other resources. We have very powerful job search tools, such as our labor market information tool that helps veterans decide what kind of career they might want to go into. It gives them information to help them make those choices. We also leverage the talents and resources of other agencies, such as Oregon National Guard, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We reach out to the Oregon Employer Council and county governments and local law enforcement to help veterans overcome the barriers that they have to getting the jobs that they want. And that concludes the portion that I came to tell you about the Oregon Employment Department. And I have to say that I'm slightly confused. I thought that I was here to bring some anecdotal information on House Bill 3207, but I'm happy to talk about our efforts at helping veterans get jobs, anything that you wish.
Well, we're happy to hear anecdotal evidence as well. Anything positive that we hear about Oregon doing for our veterans, I think, is welcome information, so please feel free.
Well, the first thing is I felt that House Bill 3207 definitely raised the awareness with the agency human resource departments about hiring veterans and giving them the preference points that they deserve. I do agree with Representative Parrish on some of the information I've heard from veterans getting back to me, and it's been very few, but there have been those who have called and said, hey, I don't understand what happened. I thought that I would get the interview or get the job based on what I understood House Bill 3207 to say. Typically, I would have them go back to the HR departments of the agency that they applied at to find out why not. And that was often the case, that they didn't meet one of the special requirements or qualifications, or had not maybe answered a question properly or something like that. So that's about all I have to say on that. If there are any other questions.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious if Chaplain Larkin or Mr. Booker may have any reports from the employer community, perhaps even anecdotally, about the success that you have achieved from the employer's perspective in the quality of the employees that they are being referred to them.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Representative Witt, one of the initiatives I didn't address that we're doing is a partnership with Dr. Leslie Hammer from Portland State University. She's received a $5 million grant from the Department of Defense and has a new initiative called SERVE, which stands for the Reemployment of Veterans. What she's doing over a five-year period of time is beginning to do interviews with veterans, especially National Guard members, and their civilian supervisors to talk about how is that working relationship. At the end of that five-year period of time, she will develop a training program for all supervisors. It'll be 1 hour online program that will talk about here are some of the unique factors that veterans experience. It will help those supervisors better understand the veterans and what they're going through. And so she's already begun to develop that in a different market, and it's going to tailor it to the state of Oregon and our own veterans, and we'll roll that out in about 2 to 3 years. So she's in the research process right now, interviewing those employers and veterans, and then we'll be able to craft that training. So that's one of the initiatives we've had. We've also vetted it through those major employers that already hire and employ the veterans to be able to say, what are your sense of some of the stresses and some of the advantages of hiring a veteran and working, having a veteran as part of your workforce. So that's one of our leading initiatives right now.
Thank you very much. And Madam Chair, if I might again.
Please.
Are we generally hearing satisfaction from the employer community? Hiring a vet's is a good proposition?
Oh, Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Representative Witt, I think there are misconceptions about a veteran. Perceptions that every veteran has PTSD and therefore is not capable of being a good employee. And I think sometimes there are pleasant surprises that veterans bring with them: leadership skills, management skills, and ability to deal with people, ability to deal with stress, the ability to plan. There are a number of skills that our veterans bring, and I think some of our employers are surprised at those skill sets and the maturity some of our veterans bring. So by and large, I think what I'm hearing from our employers is they're very pleased with the quality of workmen that we're returning as veterans and service members to their force.
And Vice Chair Fagan and Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I find the same thing. I talk to veterans, I'm sorry, employers quite often, and they want to hire veterans. One of the groups that we work with is the Oregon Employer Council, who works directly to help the employment department understand employers' needs. Our very veteran friendly. We just had a conference with them a month or so ago, and that was one of the pieces we brought in is, hey, we're here to help you hire veterans. And afterwards, we were surrounded by employers who are saying, sign me up, what can I do? And yes, we have hired veterans before, and they've been excellent employees.
That's great.
Well, also to both of you, thank you for your service. Appreciate it. And, you know, Colonel Larkin, you're certainly going to have your work cut out for you next year. It'll be a busy year. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate all of the effort, and I'll just share, you know, anecdotally. I was out at a manufacturing facility. They acknowledge that they're at least 40% veteran workforce. So, I mean, I think we're doing our jobs. I think you guys are out there and getting the word out, and I was just really pleased to see that and felt like they had good connections with, you know, the employment community to get those folks hired, and that there were a lot of avenues to find veterans. So anyway, we're doing something right.
Vice Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Parrish, Representative Witt, just this last week at the Memorial Coliseum, 460 veterans and service members went to a job fair sponsored by H2H and the employer support of the Guard and Reserve. Many of them found new jobs or better jobs, because one of the problems that we face is not only unemployment, it's underemployment. And so that was a tremendous success. And the reports I had back from the employers were they were very pleased with the quality of veteran that attended that job fair in Portland.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the update. I think that'll conclude the hearing, but keep giving us updates and suggestions for how we can make it work even better. With that, that is all that we have on the agenda today. Is there anything else for the good of the order?
So just, you know, committee bills, and I know Greg's not here, and I told him I'd give him a ring, but I think it probably makes sense that we have a, you know, whether it's juror bill or committee bill, but just kind of an omnibus as it, you know, relates to veterans and fix some of these tweaks that need to happen. So
can we get how many committee bills?
We get five.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Three.
Oh, three. Oh, we only get three this time. Okay. I think we got five before. So.
We did.
Anyway, so it looks like we're getting shortchanged this time around. But, so anyway.
Yeah, but if we just did an omnibus kind of relating to veterans.
I think so. I think some of these things can be easily kind of wrapped into, and the ones that I'm, Rick, for your purposes, looking at the, you know, what can we do about the in-state tuition tweak. The language from DAS and BOLI, they're going to kind of partner on that for 3207. And then mentioned before, and Greg has the notes on House Bill 2329 from 2011, which was not a veterans bill, but it is impacting veterans, so it might be a good place for us to come fix it. And it had to do with the ATVs and being able to use modified ATVs out on Oregon trails, and we accidentally precluded them from doing that.
Do you think that would fit into a relating to veterans? Relating
because class? I think if we can make sure that disabilities, I don't know, we can push it.
Right.
We can push it. I'm happy to try to push the envelope on that just to see if we can get that fixed. But I think if not, we can chase down a bill for that or something. So.
Great. Well, with that, I will adjourn the Interim Committee on the Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. Thanks for